Hello and welcome to another edition of the Sporting Kansas City Show on your home for SKC Soccer, Sports Radio 810 WHB, wherever you stream your video content and wherever you listen to your podcasts. We appreciate you consuming the show. And guys, I have, as we continue to evolve as Zoom-based creatures in today's world, step in the right direction for me. I was sent a visual tutorial by somebody that the Yeti microphone is supposed to be straight up and down. It is not. You don't talk into the top of it like you do other microphones. It's supposed to be just straight up and down like this. So I'm finally applying my Yeti microphone correctly for the first time. So I'm sure that's going to make all the audio quality difference in the world for you guys. We've got Allie Trost and Carter Augustine with us as always. Allie, how are you? I like the rainbow SKC shirt. I've got the actual jersey from the 2000 Cup, which is going to be a big theme for today's show. And Carter, you've got a rainbow kit on as well. How's everybody doing so far today?
Doing well. It's funny. Nate, you've got all the gizmos and gadgets. Carter and I are just screaming into the void of our apartment right now, hoping that the sound picks up with our laptops.
Some of us just take it more seriously, you know.
No, this is how bad I am at technology. So for Christmas, my dad, bless his heart, got me some AirPods. I was like, I don't know if I need them. He's like, I don't know, like, just your brother's one. I'm like, just that's like the gift to everybody. I love them. I love these things, but I have, for the life of me, cannot figure out how to connect them to my laptop. I have tried everything. Unless I'm doing it on my phone, I just like, then I've got the cord and it looks all whatever. So I'll figure it out at some point by the time this quarantine is over.
Yep. I'm glad to hear you clearly, Nate. I'm happy for you. and yeah, doing well. Hope you guys had a good Memorial weekend.
Did have a good Memorial Day weekend. I'll lay out the menu real quick, and we'll talk about a couple of things before we take a break, because we've got a special guest, and we're going to spend a lot of time with our special guest today. Tony Miola is going to join us, because coming up on Saturday at 7 o'clock and then at 9 o'clock on Fox Sports Kansas City, we are going to re-air the 2000 MLS Cup Final. Tony Miola was the star of that game, making save after save against a star-studded Chicago Fire team. I think, by the way, during our interview with Tony, I might have accidentally said DC United, because the game was in Washington, D.C., and watching back the game in my head, I keep thinking DC United, but Chicago was an incredible team at that time, the best attacking team in MLS. The Wizards were the best defensive team in MLS. An epic final, a great game. You're going to want to go back and watch that. And we're going to watch that one with Peter and Carrie.
Awesome.
That is going to be something that you'll want to make sure that you check out with the rest of us on Saturday night at 7 and 9 o'clock. And we're going to talk with Tony Miola about that. So that's coming up. I'll lay down the menu for what's coming up over the course of this week as well. On Thursday, we got the classic match between Sporting Kansas City and the Philadelphia Union from April 5th of 2015. And we've also, tomorrow on Wednesday, got For the Cheers presented by Michelob Ultra, featuring a certain Carter Augustine with Jacob Peterson. Carter, why don't you give us a little taste of what we can expect from that coming up?
It was a good one. Best one yet, I would argue. Just shout out to Jacob Peterson, the answer. And he gives his five-a-side team of players he played with throughout his career. And obviously he had such a long career in MLS, and also started out in Bradenton. So he's played with a number of fantastic players, and he actually had a lot of fun with that. And it was he's got some good teams. He went three deep. So he had some tough questions that he had to ask himself in that team. And it was really fun.
Yeah, so make sure everybody checks that out on Wednesday at 6 o'clock for the Cheers, presented by Michelob Ultra. All right, guys, latest from soccer world before we get into the interview with Tony Miola. First off, on the round of negotiations taking place between Major League Soccer and the Major League Players Association as we try to get ramped up to this. Look, there have been leaks. Apparently there have been emails about leaks. Apparently there have been leaks about the emails about the leaks. And all of that, I don't know about you guys, I can't get enough of just reading the content of what's it going to look like. Is this going to happen? None of us really know yet. But my biggest takeaway to this point is apparently, according to all these stories, you had the owners put together a plan and a proposal. The players came back with a counter proposal. The owners have already made then a counter to that counter proposal. That tells me that they're working, that they're negotiating. They're not just sitting there ignoring one another and saying, nope, it's our way, or you take a hike. No, it's our way, or you take a hike. To me, if that's the tone of this, it makes me very optimistic that the two sides will be able to work this out and we can get back to what we all want, which is hopefully a great soccer competition. What do you guys think of what's happened over the past week?
Yeah, I mean, I think it shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody that there would be a back and forth, right? I mean, there's going to be some negotiation in this process. It's not like, here's our first proposal, boom, let's go, that looks perfect, and we're ready to play. I think what we've seen, again, across not just soccer, but every single league trying to return to play, there's a lot of unknown. This is unusual. People are trying to figure out from a financial standpoint how to make it worth, from how to make it work, rather, from a health and safety standpoint, how to make it work. There's a lot of moving parts. The one thing that shouldn't come as a surprise to Don Garber is that there would be leaks with all of this, right? That's what we see whenever there is a negotiation or whenever there's big news happening, memos going out left and right. Those are going to get in the hands of reporters. That's just how this thing works. And it should be a good sign that that's, you know, being reported on, because it's keeping people in the know. So I thought the statement from Don Garber, I was a little shocked by, just because I didn't find it too surprising that those documents made it out. Carter, I don't know what you think.
Wondering how our friend Paul Tenorio and others are at The Athletic are doing now, but they obviously broke the story last week. And like you said, it is of great interest to everyone in the soccer world, so you can see why they did it. Yeah, I'm with you, Nate. I'm buoyed by the fact that there seems to be some back and forth happening. And then we're seeing a little more concrete stuff coming out of Spain and England as well, as to maybe when they could perhaps resume. So it seems to be trending in the right direction. And, you know, we saw some big crowds over Memorial weekend. So I think we're still going to maybe wait and see what happens there, but hopefully it is going to end up where it's trending towards, and that's resuming some soccer here, maybe not super soon, but hopefully soon.
Well, we know one positive from those huge crowds over Memorial Day weekend is that it leads to tweets by Ali Trost that go viral. Over 10,000 likes from a funny tweet from Ali Trost through the course of this the Lake of the Ozarks, you know, generating so much controversy.
I never thought that, like, my most, I guess this is the first time I've gone viral, which is hilarious because viral, haha, virus, haha.
Yep.
During yep. The pandemic. But I was just stating the obvious. I saw that video and I was like, oh, God. Like,
cool. I think that's why it went viral, because everybody's like, that's right, I don't want to be in that pool. I don't care, pandemic or not, there's some stuff going on in that pool that I just don't want to be mixing in with, you know?
You get in that pool and you have like a hangnail, you're getting your arm amputated. Like, you're going to come home, go to bed, wake up, and your entire hand is black. Like, I don't know what is going on there, but not for me.
Yeah, it does. Bacteria, virus, there's too many things happening in that pool, and we don't need to go there. So I'm glad that we're all safe from that situation. The other situation from the weekend that generated a lot of conversation, and again, this broadcast nerdness of us, but also soccer fan nerdness of us, at Mainz, they piped in crowd noise. And we're going to hear from Tony Miola. He actually was some good information about, I thought they were piping it in through the stadium, which apparently they're not. I personally would be in favor of that, because I think it actually might lift the level of the players a little bit as well, to make them feel like they're in a crowded arena. And I would have been against this going in, guys. And I was against it going in. I thought, no, I want to hear the Nat sounds. Let's explore with hearing the players. And it took for me was one weekend of listening to the Bundesliga and the echoes in the empty stadium to feel like, man, I think I want some crowd noise. And I thought it sounded better. I thought it sounded better as a broadcast. I think it would sound better to the players themselves. And I was spending some time thinking about it this weekend as well. We have it in FIFA, right? Like, there's crowd noise in FIFA. If you take a shot when you're playing FIFA, you know, on your video game system, and a shot sails over the bar, the crowd, oh, you know, it reacts. If we can pull it off in a video game, I don't really see why we can't pull it off in a game on the field. That's my two cents. Now I'll open up. I'll start with you, Carter. You're maybe sometimes more of a purist, really, than I am about a lot of these things. What did you think of it?
No, I think it did help the broadcast for sure. And, yeah, we'll hear some from Tony Meola about it. You have talked about the fact that calling games from tube is pretty difficult. And the fact that if you can get the crowd in your ears, it can raise your level while you're calling the game. And I think we saw that in that game. FIFA's got some algorithms that I think will be a little difficult to replicate in this particular instance. And we again talked about being that audio guy that would have to do that would be the worst job imaginable for me. But there are some capable people out there that do audio and they could do that. I don't know. Pumping it into the stadium, I think we've said this before. These are games that matter. You shouldn't have to do that to increase the play of the players on the field. As far as the broadcasters go, I agree. I think it helps. And so I'm curious to see if they'll do it a little bit more. I don't think it needs to be in the stadium, but maybe they'll try it out.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I don't necessarily think it needs to be in the stadium either, but I'm also in the camp of if it helps in any way, and this is a strange time for players who might be dealing with other things that are hard to leave off the field, given the fact that we're in a health pandemic. But I think for the broadcast, it helps so much, especially when you just consider all the different camera angles. There are a couple of times where if the shot was zoomed in enough where you hear the noise and you don't see the stands, and it felt, not that it needs to be normal by any means, but it just helped from a viewing standpoint. And I think you could tell how it helped the broadcasters as well. So I think that that's something that should stick with each and every single broadcast going forward. But Nate, I mean, it makes me think of like NFL, and there are practices where you hear teams before a big game, they'll pump in the Arrowhead sound noise if it's like, you know, an opposing team coming to Arrowhead and getting ready. Sometimes it's just good to have that replicate that kind of energy for a team, and whether that, you know, ups their play or helps them mentally lock in. Sometimes it's just that extra step in the preparation process that gets things going. So maybe it's not, you know, crowd noise in the actual game, but maybe they've got something to help simulate them beforehand.
Yeah, I think we're all for it on some level, just working it out. And I think that in terms of the guy that's got to sit there and push buttons to change the crowd, I think you keep it simple to me. Shots that happen, you hit that button that makes the crowd, ooh, that type of thing. And when they score, the crowd goes wild, maybe. I don't think you need to get into booing the referees and apparently maybe booing the players when they lose. I think you could stay away from all that and still have the benefits, but we'll see where it goes. Let's go ahead and take a break. We're going to have Tony Meola, a long-form interview. We're going to talk about all the current-day stuff, Bundesliga, MLS return to play, and we'll relive that 2000 MLS Cup final with one of the all-time greats, Tony Meola, right after this on the Sporting Kansas City Show. And we're back on the Sporting Kansas City Show on your home for SKC Soccer, Sports Radio 810 WHB, wherever you get your podcasts, wherever you stream your content. And one of the things that's been maybe a positive out of this whole pandemic is how easy it's been for us to actually connect face-to-face, so to speak, with some of our good buddies. And one of them is with us now because, boy, there's a connection here to one of the great players in franchise history, but also a guy who was a consistent part of my morning show, guys, with Stephen St. John. He used to do a show with Stephen St. John before Stephen and I even worked together. Then for a while there, when you were living in Kansas City, Tony, you were coming on with us on a weekly basis on the morning show too. We've got as his teammates used to call him, Big Tones, Tony Meola, on the show right now. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. Hopefully you guys are doing well and getting through this odd time that we're all living in right now. But I'm glad to see all the faces, and we'll chat a little bit about what happened a few years back.
We will. The impetus for having Tony on today is because we've been doing these replays of classic games with player commentary, and I got to be honest, the one – out of all of the ones we've done that I'm most excited about is the one we've got coming up this weekend, the 2000 MLS Cup final. We've got Kerry Zavagnin and Peter Vermees doing the commentary with me on this one. And just trust me, we've already taped it. People are going to want to watch that because, you know, Carrie and Peter, and I'm going to have Tony tell some stories about those guys here in a minute. Tony was the star of the show, by the way, in that game. And we talked a lot about you, Tony, when we went back and watched it. So we're going to get to that in a minute. But before we go back to reliving that year and that game with you, Tony, let's get a temperature check on you, metaphorically speaking, right now. How are things for you in Florida? How are you holding things together right now through the course of these weird times?
Yeah, well, family's doing well. Thanks for asking. I can tell you, and if you ask me for like the next 2 months, it's 85 and sunny with a chance of thunderstorms where I live every day. that's kind of where I'm at. We've been really fortunate. My parents are still up north. My mother-in-law is still up north in New Jersey, and they're doing fine, hanging in there. And I try and tell everyone as much as I when I go to put my head down on the pillow at night, I'm going stir crazy, but I tell everyone, well, we're one day closer to whenever the end is to this thing. So that's my positive message to people for the day. Hopefully in a couple of weeks, I'll be believing it myself, if you will.
Well, you mentioned a little bit about the math being a lot harder than you remember. I guess been the biggest challenge with, I know you said all your kids are home, parenting and quarantine, I know has been a big change for a lot of people.
Yeah. But when they first said, you know, my youngest is just finishing this week, his junior year of high school. And when they said, parents, you'll have to get them online and do all this stuff. And I'm not great with technology, as anyone who listens to my radio show knows. I looked at the math. He's like, Dad, can you help me for 1 second? I looked at him like, oh man, this is completely different from what I was doing in school. And I know I've heard that from so many parents. So I have a much bigger appreciation for teachers. And I already had a great admiration for teachers and what they do, but man, just not an easy job. And you know what, credit to the kids too, because when there are some kids that are disciplined enough to just turn on a computer and feel like they're in class and wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning and see the teacher on the screen. And it's normal in some ways, you know, at least they get their, for some kids, it's really difficult. My youngest, it's not ideal for him not to be in the class. And so credit to the kids that have had to sort of change their whole life and the way they do it and get through it.
Yeah, I agree. I think one positive out of all this is people like teachers might get a little bit more appreciation down the line. Hopefully that comes out of it. I feel, Tony, one of the things that we've been asking everyone, it seems kind of cliche now, but have you been watching anything to keep you busy throughout this time, reading anything?
I never was a Netflix fan. I'm going to show you one of my rundowns from yesterday here. And in the middle, you can see there's some blue. I don't know if you can see that, but I need some glasses. Let's see what I've gone through. I've done Breaking Bad, which I'm way behind. I've done all three seasons of Ozark. I've done all of Peaky Blinders. I've done The Outer Banks, believe it or not. I've done Tiger King, by the way. If you didn't do Tiger King, and then all of the soccer shows, the Brazil Take Us Home, the Boca Juniors, the Leeds United, the Concrete Football, the All or Nothing Man City. I can go on and on in this section. I never, until this pandemic, watched Netflix really in my life ever. I may have seen something on it, but I wouldn't call myself like a Netflix person where I go on the weekend. If I ever had time on the weekend after watching probably EPL and Bundesliga and then waiting at night and watching MLS and then doing basically the same thing on Sunday but adding La Liga and Serie A in, if I ever had time at night, I was probably going back and watching some of the games that I missed, you know. So, but that has all changed, obviously, for me.
The Bundesliga itself, we're taping this right before Der Klassiker between Dortmund and Bayern, but we've got a couple weekends in. What have you thought of our first glimpse of soccer coming back, these ghost stadiums? We saw them experiment with the crowd noise and the Mainz match over the weekend. What did you think so far of what we've seen? What are your biggest takeaways?
Well, from a playing standpoint, I thought some teams were really good. And Schalke's been poor. There's been some poor performances as well, which I suppose you expect. Maybe Schalke we look at under a different lens these days because Weston McKennie's there, and it's kind of been Schalke's been sort of that team that we're waiting to get into. You know, poor season last year, on a roller coaster right now. My old teammate is the manager there, David Wagner, played with him in the national team, and so I kind of have this soft spot for wanting to see him do well, but I thought overall the play has been a lot better than I thought it was. And you know, you get to MLS and you talk about the start coming sometime here in the near future, and you keep hearing the word innovative, right, from Don Garber, the commissioner. And I go, you mentioned the crowd noise. I was actually a fan of it. Some weren't. I thought it helped. And we sent the message yesterday to Phil Bonney, who's one of the guys that you're hearing on the world feed, who we have on our show all the time. And he said they actually, because we were unsure. So the crowd noise was not pumped into the stadium. So the players in the stadium didn't hear it, but we heard it at home. But what we were unsure of, whether it was pumped into the announcer's ears. And it was pumped into their ears. And he said it helped tremendously in calling the game. Like I work for CONCACAF, so I call CONCACAF games. And, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night games where you got like a couple thousand people. And we've had some closed door games. And it's like 11:30 at night on the East Coast. And you're calling your second game of the night. And you guys know you work in this business and you don't want to make up energy, you know, but you feel like you have to make up some energy. So you're kind of caught in the middle there. Do I yell at this point? Do I raise my voice? By the way, can I raise my voice? Because it's 11:30 and I've just called my second game of the night, you know, so you all these things. But he said the crowd noise pumped into his ear really, really helped the energy. And I thought, I don't know if you guys, you're in the business, obviously. I don't know if you guys thought it was funny. There's actually a guy there that has to feel the emotion of the game. At the end of that Mainz game, he actually piped in some boos when his team flubbed an opportunity. And I thought to myself, that takes a lot. You know, you're really running the risk because you're trying to go with the ebbs and the flows. And so it's not just like random noise pumped in. It's kind of emotional, and the emotion is supposed to match the game. And I thought that was pretty cool, but I'd hate to have that job. And if that guy gets on Twitter, for sure, forget it. There'll be slaughtering that guy.
Delicate dance for sure. I mean, we talked about the struggle of like pressing the right button, or what if you mess up and you're all of a sudden pumping in the wrong reaction to what just happened. But something else that was interesting, my team, which is Mönchengladbach, had the cutout fans. Did you think that was creepy or cool?
I thought it was pretty cool. And now they're taking it one step further where they're actually going to have signage with live fans, and they're going to zoom them in. So you're going to get some emotion. Look, I suppose, Allie, we have to almost be open to everything, right? And open to whatever, you know, people are just, if you can imagine, and you're in their office in Mönchengladbach, and they're saying, we need some energy. How do we do it? Now you come up with a million ideas, and they're picking one to try and, you know, they're trying to keep the fans involved. They're trying to, I thought the cutouts were a great idea, and they that money was donated to charity. Can they do that? Would they have like 13,000? Can they do a stadium of 30 something? I don't know if they can, but it's at least visually, as it goes by, it looks a little bit better. But yeah, I suppose in a lot of ways this has taken everyone back to square one. Every player that is going to training in the EPL or the Bundesliga or La Liga, everyone at some point has played in front of nobody, has taken their own gear home to wash it, and had to go to training the next day. And yeah, we're all spoiled when you get to that level because all of this stuff is done. So maybe we'll just kind of rethink sort of how lucky we are. I know from my standpoint now, and I'm sure you guys feel the same way, that it's an honor to be able to call games and to be able to work on the radio and be able to have people listen to you. Whether they agree with you or not is a completely different story, but it's an honor to be able to do that. I will never take it for granted being in a booth and calling a game and having that sort of that for me is now the high in life. You know, that's like my sporting drug is being in there and feeling the energy. I can't play anymore, obviously, but you know, that I'll never take it for granted.
While we're still in the Bundesliga, I wanted to ask about David Wagner since you brought him up. I feel like I just don't really know that much about him, despite him being a U.S. international. And then he makes this meteoric rise with Huddersfield, and now he's at Schalke. Did you see him becoming a manager, and just maybe what was he like as a player, and how do you see him as a coach now?
Well, he was always kind of a quieter player. He wasn't a rah-rah guy. And we played only a short period of time together on the national team, but we've kind of always kept in touch. I've had him on our show as he was kind of coming through the ranks, and we had him on our show when he was at Huddersfield Town and gets them through promotion. And I'm not surprised that he's a manager. He was one of those guys that could never get away just physically, right? So he had to be a cerebral player. You mentioned Kerry Zavagnin, right? Much like Kerry Zavagnin, who was such a great player, and we talk about this 2000 Cup final, that whole season, probably the most unsung guy in the entire league, and maybe one of the most unsung guys all time in our league. I haven't seen the final since 2000, right? I haven't seen it since 2000, since I was on the field. I can just remember, and he'd probably tell you better than me, how much running that guy did. And I don't know how much he touched the ball in the game, but you take him out of the game and we don't win the game, right? We just don't, we're not in that position during the season. Now, Peter was a different story because he was kind of anchoring everything. We were playing with three in the back, which was unusual. We were lucky because we had Klein on one side and Henderson on the other side. And I think they're still running those two guys. You know, they're still running up and down flanks all the time. So we were really lucky in the way that team was set up. So Peter had a little more, and he's a little more vocal in general, as you guys know, and he was like that as a player. But so when I think about David Wagner, it's kind of cut in that same mold as Kerry Zavagnin, you know, and that kind of player. I'm not surprised Kerry's a coach. I'm not surprised that players enjoy playing for Kerry. I'm not surprised that he's had success with Peter in Kansas City. None of either of their two bits of success really surprises me at all.
All right, let's jump into that 2000 Cup final then, Tony, because I got to be honest, it was a thrill for me to go, because I hadn't watched that game back probably since 2000 myself. It was 20 years ago, you know, and especially if you're not a person that played in it, your memory kind of fades and so much happens in life since then. And let's be honest, there's going to be a lot of our audience that probably has never seen it. And so what a thrill it was to go back and look at that. If you are a fan of MLS or just soccer today, the first thing that stood out to me was the cast of characters that participated in that game and where they are now. I mean, obviously you yourself, one of the top voices of soccer in this entire, you know, continent, let alone in this country. You talked about Klein and Henderson. These guys are front office guys at two of the most successful franchises in MLS. Peter and Kerry, same situation there. You look on the other, and Preki, you know, has been a head coach at the MLS level and still there. You look on the other side, Jesse Marsh, you know, who's won a supporter shield and is now doing groundbreaking things as an American manager in Europe. Chris Armas, who followed him up. Carlos Bocanegra. I mean, like, Bob Bradley was the head coach of that DC United team.
Keep in mind, you got C.J. Brown, who also has been an assistant for years. You got Ante Razov, who's an assistant. I'm trying to think off the top of my head, with LAFC, with Bob. You got Zach Thornton, who's been an assistant and a goalkeeper coach, I don't know, probably, I'm going to guess, 10 or 12 years now. And the list, Peter Novak, who we know was at Philly. Lubas Kubek, who was at a World Cup with Jurgen Klinsmann, and the list goes on and on in that group. I'm glad you mentioned that part of it, Nate, because there's some really important. Okay, the game is one thing, and 2000 was special in Kansas City, but there's it's important that we continue to use the guys that built the sport, and those guys were there, and they're all helping it to build in very different ways, but all equally as important in what they're doing.
Well, a couple of things that struck me about that is just okay. When you get to a point of a championship game, you're going to see a lot of guys that will go on to continue to do great things because they're great. That's why they're in a championship game. But I think we spend so much time, maybe rightfully so, talking about the improvements of the league over the last 5 years, 10 years, whatever, and how the leaps and bounds that the league has made. But I tell you what, you go back in 2000, the league was so much smaller, the concentration of great players was kind of what stood out to me too. It was like, they look like two all-star teams out there in many ways. And what I thought was crazy is you guys were kind of considered the unwanteds. Everybody had kind of been bounced around. But look at how many great players were on both teams because there weren't as many teams in the league at that time.
Yeah, I can't imagine what some of the guys would be worth in this day and age in the league. You know, what would you pay for a center back? And I'm talking about Peter Vermes, who organizes everything, right? How many of those do we have in the league right now that are that vocal and are that confident in organizing? What would you pay for a Miklos Molnar, who I think we won like 8 or 9 1-0 games that year, and he scored 7 of the goals in that point. He just cared about scoring in big moments. What would you pay for, you know, the two Chris's on either side that are there's no more box there. There's no more box to box guys in world football anymore. It's just too much work to do. Those guys would have come as close to working that way as anyone that you would see in the game. I mean, and let's go the other side of the coin, like what would Chris Armas be worth as a number 6 right now in this league? And and I get it's a different era, but I'm just trying to make a point that there were some really I don't want this to get masked by the fact that it was 2000, right? There was really, really good players, and those are players for me that can still compete in any era that we've had in Major League Soccer so far.
Tony, I want to touch on something that you said about the organization factor with working with Peter Vermes. And that was one thing that stood out to me. I've watched a lot of these games back now, especially the conference final series against LA, and just the command that you and Peter had of the entire team just from that backfield. What was it like working with Peter in that way? And how strong of a connection did the two of you have in order to lead the team in the way that you did oftentimes through the organization?
Yeah, Ali, we talked about it every day. And one thing sticks out for me from Peter that season. I told this story not too long ago. It's funny that you're asking. Was Game 1. We were at home against Chicago. So we started and ended with Chicago. And they also ended our 13-game start at the season of an unbeaten streak. I think it was game 14 that we lost in Chicago. It might be 13. I could be one off. But anyway, We win opening night, and this is, we used to call ourselves the Misfits, right? As Nate said, no one wanted us. We had all got traded to Kansas City, and it was like the black hole at the time, you know? And you go to Kansas City, and you're like, oh, man, is this like the end now, you know? But it was the beginning of something great, and we didn't know it. And we came in, and we won 4-3. It was an exciting game. Goalkeeper Sutton was his name from Chicago, gave us a gift to make it 4-2. Then Ante Razov, I believe, scores, makes it 4-3. And Peter came in, and everybody is excited. And, you know, we're win opening night. That's what you want to do. We were so poor the year before. Chicago was so much, so far ahead of us the year before. And Peter was not happy. And he let the entire locker room know that he was not happy that we gave up 3 goals. And you know, there were some things said that I probably can't say, but it woke us up, and it said, you know what, we're better than this. We're better than giving up 3 goals in a game here. And I think it was just a message. It was the right message, and again, goes back to why he's probably had success. It was the right message at the right time. I tell you, it's the first game of the season, and some people might go, what's kind of odd, you're yelling at the first game of the season, you just won, you know, maybe you got to work some kinks out. No, we didn't have time for that, and Peter didn't have time for that, and I was on board with him, and I thought, you know what, no one had to say a word, because he hit the nail on the head, that this was the right time, and this was the right tone, and the right message that we needed at that particular moment after coming off a long preseason where we traveled to South America and we stayed down there for quite some time. And this is what the team needed at that moment. And again, I can't imagine that he hasn't had 100 of those speeches over the last 10 years with his teams.
So you talk about coming in being the Misfits, and you started the season off, like you said, so well. Did you have a feeling that you got to be something special, which you wound up being at the end of the season?
I think that team thought we were going to be good right in preseason when everybody came, because everyone had a chip on their shoulder, right? Everyone was kind of cast away from some, McEwen. Matt McEwen was cast away from somewhere. Henderson was. Miklos came and no one knew who he was. And Mo Johnson had been there and he was at the point of I think Mo clearly knew that this was going to be his last year. So he wanted the right guys in. And then Bob Gansler comes in and is just the organizer, you know, the guy that put all the pieces together and said, hey, you guys, you know, it's funny because Bob Gansler gets credit for putting together one of the best defensive teams I think the league has ever had. I don't know, you know, where we are numerically, but we're up there, I'm sure. We never worked on defending, ever. We never worked on defending. We worked on being organized. And I think Bob Gansler said, I got Peter and I've got Tony, and I'll let them, their voice is gonna mean a lot more in the game than my voice is from the sideline. I'll let you get, and we talked to Bob about it. But we worked on attacking. I think the one thing this team doesn't get credit for, I believe Chicago was the best attacking team in the league, right? And I think it was LA next, if I'm not mistaken, the LA Galaxy. And then it was us. We were third in the league in attacking. So it wasn't as if we didn't score goals, but I think what people sort of, I don't want to say misunderstood or maybe read into a little bit too much was the fact that we were so comfortable in 1-0 games. 1-0, that was it. The door was locked and it was shut and that was it. We may as well, we could have stopped at that point in most of those games, you know, and that's the way our team felt. I can remember a game at Tampa with, what was his name? Mamadou Diallo, right? The big forward from Tampa Bay. And screaming, we were up 1-0 in Tampa. We just sat back in Tampa. They couldn't deal with us on a counter. We had some opportunity. We could have made it 3 or 4-0. We were just a little bit sloppy in front of goal. And I can remember him cursing throughout the game from being frustrated in a game. And this, he was one of the top forwards in the league that year. I don't know who led the league in scoring, but he had to be up there. He was certainly one of the more dangerous guys. And it stuck out to me that, man, we really do frustrate teams. Like, we really do make it hard on teams to score goals. And there were moments where we got lucky. You go to the final, Stoichkov in the first, I don't know, what, 5 minutes or so. He's only like, I'm going to guess he's 8. I can still see his eyeballs now. Scary character looking at him on that left peg, and he hits the crossbar and the outside of the post with a shot. You know, if that goes in, that's a completely different ball game. You know, there were so many moments in that game, but that's the way the season went. When you win a championship, things go your way. And when you're losing, you always feel like every one of those things goes against you. Every call, every bad bounce, you know, I've been unfortunately on that side as well. And you go home, you scratch your head, you're like, oh man, we kicked the crap out of that team tonight, but we lost 3-0, you know. How the hell did we lose 3-0? And that stuff happens, and it's cyclical. You see in Kansas City, who'd have thought last year Kansas City, you know, the Sporting Kansas City would have been in a position they were in with the talent they had. Right. I mean, you wouldn't have guessed that at the beginning of the season, but sometimes you just get in a rut, and sometimes on the flip side, you get on a run and you make it all the way through the finals.
Well, and we've got Tony Meola on the line with us. You mentioned Miklos, and he had a great story because he scores the match winner in playing in that game, assuming that was going to be the last game of his career. That's a heck of a way to go out. But you had a storyline too that was really powerful. Your father was battling cancer at the time in 2000. And I believe you had said that he didn't get to watch any of your games in person that season until the final. Is that right?
That's it. Yeah. He had been going through chemo. He basically had his last chemo treatment 48 hours before the game. And my cousin in New Jersey, now remember that game was in DC.
Yep.
And my cousin Pat said, he said to my father, I'm coming to pick you up. He said, I got a bed in the back of my van for you. You can sleep the whole way down. You can do whatever you want. And I didn't, the only regret I have, I didn't get to see my father after game. I saw him in the stands. And then after there was an auxiliary building outside of RFK. I don't know what you call it, but they had it already set up that, you know, our team would go there after the game, regardless of the result, to see our families. But my dad was too tired. My cousin Pat had to take him home. And this was kind of before the time where you were like texting and FaceTiming and all of that stuff, you know? So it wasn't like I couldn't really, I couldn't really talk to him, but I got to talk to him that later that night when they got home. It was about a 4-hour drive, and he was just drained. But it just to know that he was in the stadium, I didn't know he was in the stadium until after the game, until one of my kids came down on the field and said, "Oh, Pop's up there." You know, I was like, "Whoa, my father's in the stadium." You know, I had no idea that he was coming to the game. You know, and I got to wave to him. And you could tell he was just, as you can imagine, kind of, it was his third round of chemo at the time, and he was just drained. And luckily, he's still alive today, so we can still talk about 2000 and you know how special that was. But yeah, you had the story right. That was his first day out in like 4.5 months or something like that.
Wow.
A lot of kids play sports. I mean, I know myself included, the role of the parent in all of it and the journey that you take to reach, I mean, in your case, the highest level of the game. How important was your dad's role in your career from the youngest ages to even now?
Oh, you know, I'm first generation in the U.S., Allie, so I didn't grow up speaking English. You know, I grew up speaking Italian, and this was my dad's dream. You know, he grew up in Italy and played in the youth club in Avellino, but, you know, quit really quickly. And as you know, the sport was so big. And in 82, I was a big Italian national team fan, and Dino Zoff was my hero. And I rode around with an Italian flag on my bike all around town for 2 years, you know, and with the only other Italian in town, my best friend Sal Rosamilia, you know, the two of us were the only two Italians in town. And that's kind of how my love for the game grew, through my dad introducing me, my mom and dad really introducing me. They're both from Italy. They were both born there, didn't come here until they were in their late teens, came 2 years apart, although they had met in Italy, and ended up getting married while they were in the U.S. You know, so this is kind of, you know, when I told my father I was going to play baseball, man, you can imagine I was like the enemy at the dinner table. What is this baseball? You know, now my father, when the Yankees don't win, forget it. I get a phone call, you know, like my father, he can't miss a Yankee game, you know. So, and of course, because my boys have played baseball so long, he has another interest. But, yeah, it was the guy's my hero. You know, I hope the way I think about my dad now, I hope one day my kids think about me that way. If I could get if they could think of me half as much as I think of my father, I think, you know, I've won.
Definitely. I think it's interesting. You said you haven't watched the game backs in all these years, and
I already saw it, Carter. I saw what I needed to see.
Well, you still remember Stoichkov's eyes, so I got to think, it's in the back of your mind there. But you're not the first person. We've been doing a lot of these games, and you're not the first player to say that they haven't watched the game back.
Peter and Kerry said they hadn't watched it back.
Oh,
either.
Really?
Yeah.
This one for me sticks out in particular because a lot of people say this is perhaps the greatest MLS Cup final performance of all time by you. 10 saves in the game, and many people put it up there with one of the greatest Cup final performances of all time. What I want to hear, maybe what else sticks out in your memory from the game? You talked about Stoichkov's eyes already, seeing the whites of them. What comes to mind about the game itself?
One of my future teammates, Diego Gutierrez, who was on that Chicago Fire team, when he first came to the locker room, I'll never forget it. He kind of came in. We were excited because he was in his prime at the time, and he was coming to our team, and we needed a left-footed player at that moment and a left-sided player. And the first thing I said is, "Man, how the hell did you miss that shot? I don't know if you remember the free kick that went up in the air," and everyone just kind of stared. And all of a sudden, before we knew it, it bounced and everyone missed it. And then Diego Gutierrez was probably, he couldn't have been, I don't know, 3 yards away, maybe even closer. And he pings it off. He said he was trying to roof it in the upper part of the net. And he obviously hit it too clean and it goes off the crossbar. And I think it was at that moment where I realized that this was our day. This was we're set up for this today. And the other thing that sticks out to me, people probably never knew, there's a shot that Stoichkov hits, a side volley. First time it ever happened in my career. He hit it so hard, but he hit it right at me, and I grabbed it. I grabbed it clean, and he completely ripped the palm of my glove all across my fingers. And I was yelling to the sideline. I'm like, "I need new gloves." And they're like, "You can't hear anything." They're like, "What?" I'm like, "I need new gloves." I'm screaming at, you know, the sideline, and no one's paying attention. And Bo O'Shaughnessy, who was the backup at the time, came running down. He's like, "What's up?" I go, look, he ripped my gloves. And he's like, oh, you know, only one guy on the bench understands what's going on. That's the other goalkeeper, you know. So, I remember that. And then I remember the 6 minutes. I remember the 6 minutes going up. And at that time, I don't know that I've ever seen 6 minutes of extra time, of stoppage time in a game. And I'm thinking to myself, whoa, 6 minutes. And I talked to Paul Tamarino after that, and he said to me, he was the referee that game, and he said to me that was the first time he had ever seen 6 minutes as well, and how they kind of came to this was odd. And one other thing sticks out. I mentioned Paul Tamarino. He says all the time, I say he's the best referee ever we've had in the league. And every time I say that to him, he says, that's because I didn't throw you out in the final. And if it were today, I probably would have been close to getting thrown out. There was a ball that went out of bounds, and Ante Razov was on my left side, and Ante Razov was trying to keep it in play and then trying to fool the referee a little bit, and I just took a swipe at him. I mean, I literally took him out. Mm-hmm. And had Paul Tamarino had a moment in that game where he said, I don't like what's going on. Luckily, it was a clean game. A cleaner game, if you will, and it wasn't heated up in that way, but it could have been a whole different story at that point.
Yeah, Peter, and people should watch it because Peter talks about that, and he talks about how back in those days, the players had a relationship with the referee, and
yeah,
there was a back and forth, and you know, it was like everybody was kind of working together. That people will want to hear as well. It was a hot day too, Tony. So. Those you guys protecting that lead for 80 minutes, and then you get the 6 minutes of stoppage time for all those guys running around, and that it was a lot warmer than it normally would be in an October game, right?
Yeah, no doubt. And in D.C., of all places, I remember we played the first half in the sun, and we were in the shade in the second half. You know, we were doing a lot of defending in that shade. So, but again, it was a moment where we felt comfortable, and Bob Gansler pushed all the right buttons. And I remember he brought on Uche Okafor, who the years, unfortunately, Uche's not with us anymore. But the years that, but prior to me coming in, Uche was one of the best defenders in the league, one of the best center backs in the league. And then when we went to three in the back. We had a Brandon Prudhoe who was on the left side, who was as quiet a professional as you're ever going to play with, but you never made a mistake. Just didn't make mistakes. You just kind of knew you were never going to be in awe of his game, and you knew he was never going to make a mistake. He forced coaches to keep him in the game. Because you knew every single game, this is what you were getting. So you didn't have to worry about that position. Clearly, with Peter on in the middle of the field, you knew he was going to organize. And then we had Nick Garcia, who was a rookie that year. Yeah. And hadn't established a reputation of being sort of a hard-nosed guy that's going to always take an extra, you know, leave his foot in a tackle and all of that stuff. And Peter was really molding him. You know, day by day, he was molding him. Play by play, he was molding him. I'm sure if you talk to Nick, he'd say, yeah, Pete never shut the hell up the entire season, you know, and just was in my – but I saw it from behind, and I saw this whole thing kind of, you know, developing. And it was just – I don't know how to – it's so hard to explain. I guess the everyone's probably watching this Last Dance, right, with Michael Jordan and how this thing is playing out. You got – okay, everyone knows the story of Michael Jordan didn't make his JV team until – he didn't make varsity until he was a junior. You know, kind of – I feel like that story's worn out. But do they know that Scottie Pippen was a manager, right, in college when he started? Mm-hmm. Do they know what was it, Steve Kerr, who had one offer – to play college basketball, like, and Dennis Rodman. I mean, forget the sort of post pro Dennis Rodman. Like, kid didn't even want to play in high school. Played at a small college. So my point is that it was just a group of guys that were put together, and the sum of the parts was so great. And Bob Gansler has to get credit for all of it because he realized we didn't have all the superstars. We haven't even mentioned Preki. Like. Preki may be, for me, one of the top 10 players ever in Major League Soccer. You tell me someone that dices you up. We look at Vela now, right? And Vela should get all the credit that he does. For me, Preki was equally as dangerous getting around the box. And I think what Bob Gansler did was took all the pressure off of Preki and said, here's Kerry Zavagnin and Matt McEwen behind you. You do whatever you want to do. You don't have to defend if you don't want to. You don't, because these guys are going to do all the work. And we're going to couple it with Chris Klein on that right side, and we know the work that he's going to do, right? And you look at that group. And the other amazing thing was we used the same lineup, I felt like, every single game. You don't see that all the time. I mean, I felt like that lineup never changed. And I almost felt bad for the substitutes because you're like, they're still working their ass off all week and they just can't break into the lineup. You know, they just can't get in. I think that was kind of Bob's MO that year.
Yeah. Peter talked a lot about during this broadcast, we're going to do about that consistency and why that mattered in terms of the organization you guys had. I'll tell you what, we could talk about this for a long time, but I will direct everybody and we'll send you a link, Tony, so you can go back and watch. And Kerry and Peter really talked a lot about, I mean, you were the star. Like I said, you were the star of that show.
I don't know, but I appreciate it.
There's no mistaking it. No one that watches that, you can be modest, but the rest of us watch it and we saw it. So, and I think it is something that's important for sport. I'm going to say this to you Sporting Kansas City fans, if you don't really know or remember about it, because there's been so much phenomenal goalkeeping play from this organization. And we talk about Jimmy Nielsen and the records he set and now Tim Mealy and the records they set, and rightfully so because they're tremendous goalkeepers. You don't know about the history of the goalkeeping in Kansas City if you don't see this performance from the guy that was the MLS MVP that season, by the way, as well. So go watch it Saturday, 7 o'clock, and then again at 9 o'clock. If you miss it at 7, you can watch it at 9 o'clock on Fox Sports Kansas City. And Tony, we really appreciate the time, man. It's great to see you. I'm glad you're healthy. And hopefully we can do this again with you sometime real soon.
You got to love you guys. Thanks. And we'll catch up, hopefully in Kansas City one day.
There you go. That's Tony Miolo, the man who brought that first MLS Cup to Kansas City. And we're going to watch it on Saturday night. Back after this to wrap up the Sporting Kansas City show right after this. And we're back to wrap things up on another edition of the Sporting Kansas City Show. Napier Katie, Allie Trost, and Carter Augustine. Our thanks to Tony Miolo for joining us on the show. And, boy, it was cool to hear him, guys, light up. And how much he can remember 20 years later from that game, especially considering the fact he's never gone back to watch it again.
That's what's been blowing my mind in talking to a lot of these players is that, one, Carter, like you had mentioned, this seems to be a common theme throughout Major League Soccer, at least with Sporting Kansas City, formerly, you know, Wizards players, that they don't watch these big games or like they lived it in the moment. They're like, yeah, that's about it. But they still remember every single like detail from the game. That was really impressive.
Yeah, that was wild. And like we talked about, I mean, this is one of the greatest cup final performances in American history. And he hasn't gone through and watched it, but he didn't even mention any of his saves, I don't think. He talked about the one that broke his glove.
Yeah.
But then he talked more about the two that crashed off the crossbar. So he still remembers that as well. That was really cool.
Yeah, and that, go ahead, Allie.
Love too is him talking about the connection he had with Vermees and the way that they led that defense that they didn't even practice really like in, you know, during the week defending. Like they were just kind of dependent on Miola and Vermees really just organizing and leading defensively, and then how that, you know, trickled up the field as well. So just really cool to hear the championship, you know, team and looking back on a season where you were so successful.
And it sounds like they had that championship mentality from the start, and he talked about all the 1-0s that they had. And you see over the history of soccer, a team that can close out 1-0s, they're usually so good and are able to reach that championship level. So that was really cool to hear as well.
Yeah, I'm going to fight so hard the urge to mention Jose Mourinho because I'm just, you know, I don't like to, but he could grind out a 1-0 and won a lot of championships that way. I'm going to give a plug again for those of you that want to watch this. I think that there's been a lot of positive feedback from the player commentaries that we've done, from Matt Beasler to Jimmy Nielsen to Benny Failhaber to Jacob Peterson and Tim Melia, Graham Zusi, all the guys we've done these games with. They've all brought something to the table and they've all been fun. So it's probably not fair to sit there and pick a favorite, but my gosh, you guys are going to want to hear from Peter and Kerry on this. They're not just players, they're coaches. They come at it from 20 years now too of perspective. And we really got into the things that Peter Vermees learned about team building, championship character, and all of that through winning that championship and being a part of that team that express themselves in the way he runs the club now. Very different styles to play, by the way. The way they played back in 2000 versus the way that Sporting plays now, and the systems are different. But the idea of what it means to build a team and having the right guys for the right positions and maybe not necessarily having that one big star and everybody else built around him, it's in the kind of leadership qualities he looks for. Those are great. They tell some funny stories. I asked Peter about, watching the Jordan documentary, which is what The Last Dance was really the Jordan story. And the way he would test other players. Do you have what it takes to be a champion? And I asked Peter about that. He tells a really funny story about guys slapping each other on the butt and congratulating each other for good practices after the first week of practice. You'll want to hear that story from Peter as well. It's a lot of fun. So make sure you check that out because it's going to be fun. Other thing I want to say, guys, before we wrap up, we're taping this right before Der Klassiker between Dortmund and Bayern Munich. But the three of us, along with Connell McCourt, did a little Bundesliga preview show. I'm assuming we're going to do another one later this week that you'll be able to find on social media channels. I am loving the fact that we have some good midweek games now, too. We had the last two weekends to look forward to. Now we get some midweek games as well. I think the Bundesliga is going to be fun again this week.
It made the return to work after a long weekend a little easier knowing that you could have a huge game on, to look forward to. So I'm pumped for this. I'm really hoping. I know that it hasn't really been the case in the last couple of years, but I'm really hoping someone can dethrone Bayern. I know, Carter, you might not think that's going
to
be.
I mean, it's going to be fun to watch, and we're taping this after, but we already know Bayern's going to win today. I'm pretty confident in that. But, we'll see. Gio Reyna on the bench. Hopefully he gets in. I'm with you. Hopefully someone can dethrone Bayern, and today would be the day that it would need to happen this year.
Well, if Dortmund ends up winning, we are going to light Carter up when we do the Bundesliga show at the end of the week. That's for sure. Well, for Tony Miola, for Ali Trost, Carter Augustine, this is Nate Buchady saying thanks for watching or listening to the Sporting Kansas City show, and we'll see you again next week.